in the limelight.
By supporting the Saudis and UAE, President Biden not only has abandoned promises he made after first taking office in January 2021, but is also fueling the war and aggravating Yemen's retaliation against its aggressors, says Ahmad Abdul Karim, journalist, in an article published under the heading, As U.S. renews support for Saudi war in Yemen, civilian death toll nearly doubles. Stay tuned for more. Two parallel but very different meetings took place recently, one in search of peace, the other to plan more war. In Oman's capital, Muscat, an official delegation headed by Ansarullah met with Omani and European officials to negotiate de-escalation and humanitarian assistance in Yemen. Meanwhile, the United States and the Saudi-led coalition held meetings to plan a ground escalation in Sana'a and Hajjaj province in Yemen's southeast to coincide with airstrikes against residential neighborhoods in other cities throughout the north, which have killed and injured dozens of people and caused extensive damage to property and infrastructure. In the wake of Joe Biden's pledge of support to the Saudi king during a call and a corroborating statement by CENTCOM commander General Kenneth F. McKenzie Jr., the Saudis wasted little time translating this support into ground action. The oil-rich country, supported by American and British military planners and expats and a large number of mercenaries, has imposed an oppressive siege on Harath, a strategic Yemeni city in Hajjaj province. Situated near the Yemen-Saudi border, Harath lies emptied of people and largely destroyed by Saudi airstrikes and artillery bombardment. The crippling siege is designed to pave the way for a ground invasion of the city, which oversees the Red Sea port of Mehdi in Yemen's far northwestern reaches. The city was once relatively prosperous, benefiting from smuggling and cross-border trade. When the Saudis announced their military operation, dozens of people have been killed, and hundreds of families have fled their homes as Saudi bombs devastate the city and the roads leading into and out of it. Harath was not the only target of Saudi violence. U.S.-backed coalition forces dropped hundreds of tons of bombs on densely populated cities including Sana'a, Al-Hudaydah, Hajja, Sa'de, Ma'rib, and Al-Jawf. In Sana'a, where Saudi forces uncharacteristically gave a 72-hour evacuation notice to government facilities, warplanes razed the Ministry of Telecommunications and Information Technology, destroying communication systems and triggering an internet blackout. U.S.-backed coalition forces also bombed several areas of the capital around the ministry. The Yemeni parliament said that the bombing of the telecommunications sector was intended to isolate Yemen from the rest of the world, adding that Saudi Arabia and UAE aim to carry out more massacres and war crimes in defiance of the international community. Since May 2019, when Ansarullah government unveiled National Vision to heal, rebuild, and modernize their war-torn nation, Yemeni government facilities and ministries have succeeded in establishing relative stability, managing a population of more than 15 million people, and keeping the exchange rate at 600 riyals per US dollar. Now, Saudi Arabia claims that government facilities are being used for military purposes. Ansarullah has denied the claims and invited foreign media to visit all government facilities, adding that the bombings will not break the people's will. Even during the 72-hour evacuation period, Saudi airstrikes pounded the streets leading to the airport and the most important entrances to the capital. Oil-rich Ma'rib and Al Jaf also came under Saudi attack, while a citizen was killed and three wounded in the Al Muslab area in Al Tuhita district in Al Hudaydah. In the past week alone, Saudi Arabia has violated the Al Hudaydah ceasefire agreement 1,426 times. Saudi airstrikes also targeted Sa'deh province, where witnesses told Min Press News that many people, including African immigrants in Al Raq area, in Al Muniba border district, were killed by Saudi shelling. In addition, the districts of Araza, Shada, and Kitaf were subjected to all-out air raids, the most violent since a January 22nd Saudi coalition attack on a Yemeni civilian prison. Amid the escalation, President Biden held a call with Saudi King Salman bin Abdul Aziz, where he reaffirmed the United States' commitment to back the Saudi-led coalition. On February 8, CENTCOM Commander McKenzie told UAE's state-owned WAM news agency that the United States is working with the UAE and other regional and global partners to develop more effective solutions to stop Yemeni drone attacks even before they are launched, sparking concerns that the U.S.-backed Saudi coalition could launch even more preemptive attacks against Yemen under the pretext of stopping the attacks on Saudi and UAE targets. Recently, a shipment of F-22 fighter jets arrived in UAE from the United States. Save the Children has described January as the bloodiest month since 2018 for Yemen, stating that one Yemeni civilian was either killed or wounded every hour during the last month. Between January 6 and February 2, more than 220 adults and 15 children were killed, and over 354 adults and 30 children were injured as well, Save the Children said in a recent report. In the January 22 Saudi coalition attack on the Sa'deh city remand prison, UAE warplanes dropped precision-guided bombs made by U.S. weapons manufacturer Raytheon, the latest piece in the border web of evidence of the use of U.S.-manufactured weapons in incidents that could amount to war crimes, according to Amnesty International. Since November 2021, the Biden administration has approved multiple arms deals with Saudi Arabia, including a $650 million agreement to sell Raytheon missiles to the kingdom and a $28 million contract for U.S. maintenance of the kingdom's aircraft. In December, the administration stated that it remains committed to the proposed sale of $23 billion in F-35 aircraft, MQ-9B drones, and munitions to the UAE. These weapons bring death and destruction to civilians in Yemen, but are less effective against Yemen's army and Ansarullah, which have gradually grown stronger, leaving Riyadh and Abu Dhabi bogged down in the country and looking for more support. U.S.-made weapons are not the only cause of extensive destruction and piling up of civilian victims in the war-torn country. The U.S.'s aggressive diplomatic stance has also taken a significant toll. Washington's diplomatic efforts, paired with a seemingly endless supply of the Persian Gulf oil money, have brought about the dissolution of the UN's monitoring mechanism in Yemen and have effectively given Saudi Arabia and the UAE carte blanche to commit rampant, horrific human rights violations in the country. In October, the UN Human Rights Council voted to disband its eminent international and regional experts on Yemen group. It was the first time that the United Nations top rights body had rejected a draft resolution since it was founded in 2006. The resolution brought forward by European nations and Canada was defeated by 21 votes to 18. The removal of this crucial human rights investigative body took us back to unchecked horrific violations, the Norwegian Refugee Council's country director, Irene Hutchinson, lamented in a statement. According to a recent report by the Norwegian Refugee Council, the civilian death toll in Yemen has almost doubled since the United Nations rights body dissolved its monitoring mechanism in the war-torn country. In the 4 months before the end of the human rights monitoring, 823 civilians were injured or killed in the war. In the 4 months that followed, there were 1,535 civilians, according to data from the Civilian Impact Monitoring Project. During the same period, 39 times more than of the civilian casualties were caused by airstrikes. By supporting the Saudis and UAE, President Biden not only has abandoned promises he made after first taking office in January 2021, but is also fueling the war and aggravating Yemen's retaliation against its aggressors. According to Yemeni officials who spoke to Min Press, Biden did not need to supply his allies with weapons, intelligence, and training if he cared about the Saudis and Emirates. They said, to end the brutal war and keep his allies safe, Biden should dictate to his friends to stop the war and lift the blockade. In return, the Yemeni attacks will stop immediately.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hi everyone, this is Mohammed. Welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address most significant issues in the subcontinent that affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole.
In this special edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the row over the Muslim headscarf in the southern Indian state of Karnataka and how it constitutes blatant violation of religious freedom. And we shall also look at the ruling Hindu Nationalist Party anti-Muslim agenda and hideous attempts to fan the flames of communalism.
In the world's largest democracy, young Muslim women are fighting the biggest and most decisive battle of their lives. The ban on wearing hijab in schools in a southern Indian state has become a new flashpoint in the battle over rights of religious minorities in India, sparking global outcry. While Muslim students have stood their ground and refused to cave in, radical Hindu groups backed by the state have been resorting to extreme repressive measures to enforce the diktat.
The southern Indian state of Karnataka, governed by the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party, has been rocked by protests in recent months over the ban on hijab in government-run schools. The controversy erupted last December at a girls' school in the city of Udupi when several hijab-clad Muslim students were denied entry into classrooms. The girls' students protested over what they believed was a violation of their right to religious freedom, guaranteed under Article 25 of the Indian Constitution. Since then, protests have spread to other cities in the southern Indian state as well as the national capital, New Delhi, as more schools have moved to implement a similar ban on the Islamic headscarf under the pressure of radical hate-mongering Hindu groups. Stung by growing protests, the government in Karnataka last week ordered closure of high schools and colleges in the state, and the matter reached the region's high court. Muslim girl students filed a petition to question how their hijab was disturbing equality, integrity, and law and order, on the basis of which the state government had banned them from the school. The court referred the matter to a bigger bench as it involves constitutional questions of personal law.
I think that the courts are, and I think that the courts have consistently in the past as well upheld religious freedoms, upheld what they believe is the, like I said, a standard essential religious practice. But I think that the difficulty that I personally am seeing in this particular debate is, I think that instead of handling the question sort of head on and saying that, well, it is not the job of the individual who is seeking the ban to explain why this is an essential religious practice. It is the job of the state to explain why it is curtailing the exercise of this freedom. And so what the Karnataka High Court has now done as an interim measure is to say that nobody can exercise any of their religious practices. And so in the interim, in order to uphold public order, the court has said that, well, you know, even Hindus can't wear shawls or Muslims, and therefore Muslim women can also not wear hijab. But I think what they are conflating is that, first of all, Hindus wearing shawls, you know, wearing saffron shawls, is not necessarily, at least from my understanding, a religious practice which they really felt the need to earlier exercise. I think it was a reaction to Muslim women wearing hijabs. So I think that by comparing the two of them and making them equal, the court may have made this a harder issue for itself to solve, because I think that the question is still very simple. The question is just, there are freedoms, and there are freedoms of equality, and then there are freedoms of religion. And unless there is an overwhelming public interest to curtail either of them, the courts must necessarily favor the right to exercise those freedoms.
Protests against what is being seen as a flagrant violation of religious freedom in the Democratic Republic of India have spread far and wide, causing Narendra Modi government in New Delhi a huge embarrassment. Amidst the chaos, a Muslim student from Karnataka has become a symbol of heroic fight against right-wing hooliganism and the BJP's government's anti-Muslim policies. Muskan Khan's viral video, in which she confronts a Hindu mob with thunderous chants of Allahu Akbar, has caught the imagination of well-meaning people across India and beyond.
On the cold, wintry morning of February the 8th, a young Muslim student, Muskan Khan, parked her bike outside her school in the southern Indian state of Karnataka. Wearing hijab as she scampered across the school grounds, a group of men sporting saffron scarves, clothing associated with right-wing Hindu groups, accosted her in an intimidating way. A viral video of the incident showed the mob heckling her and demanding that she take off her face and head coverings. They hollered Jai Shri Ram, a slogan of radical Hindu groups. In response, the brave girl, far from being intimidated, looked them in the eye and chanted Allahu Akbar while punching her fist in the air as a sign of protest. The video became viral on social media, provoking strong reactions from civil society, media, and Muslim groups in the country.
Every religion has a freedom. India has a unity, so every religion has a freedom.
I think it's extremely brave. And I think that, you know, women individually have been fighting this fight, and this is across the board, I think, especially women from minority religious communities in India. They've been fighting this fight on an individualized scale. And it started in Udupi much earlier in December itself in Karnataka. because some of these rules are completely new. There seems to be no reason why an educational institution has to come up with this when for 30 odd years, you know. Of course, there are school uniforms, and that's a whole other debate, but, you know, large colleges do allow people to wear what they want to wear, subject to certain broad restrictions. So I think that this video of this girl confronting the vigilante, it's definitely extremely powerful. And I think that it opened up a lot of debates. It opened up older debates in India about really how hard it is for women across the to exercise their rights to feel enfranchised, to feel like they have a voice in something that is happening very concretely to them. So I definitely this is it's an important video, and it's an important memory for India to remember what women have faced on a basis to even be able to enforce something that is extremely basic and really universal at all.
The confrontation between the schoolgirl and the mob of Hindu zealots illustrates the thinning religious divide in India under the Narendra Modi-led BJP government and increasing vulnerability of religious minorities. The viral video has inspired an online pain in India, Muslim women reasserting their religious identity. The hashtag #HijabIsOurRight has been trending on Twitter, resonating with people across the world.
The controversy over hijab in India divided the nation among those who defend the ban and those who oppose it. Politicians and activists associated with the Hindu national government at the center and states have gone out of their way to support the ban on women's headscarf. On the other hand, some opposition parties, civil society groups and Muslim organizations have announced what they see as the blatant breach of India's constitution and fundamental rights.
The right-wing government in Karnataka last week issued a note in support of the school's ban on hijab. In a circular, it directed schools and colleges in the state to strictly enforce a uniform dress code. In response, one of the students filed a legal petition arguing that wearing the scarf was a fundamental right to religion guaranteed by the Indian Constitution. The court will now have to decide hijab constitutes an essential religious practice and whether the ban is warranted.
It's an individual right. So practicing a religious belief or practicing on their heads, it's a visual right. So rights has to be prevailed. That's rights has been given to the students.
The opponents of the ban contend the issue, which pertains to freedom of conscience and free profession, practice and propagation of religion, enshrined in Article 25 of the institution. However, the government officials in Karnataka think otherwise.
In my college, when I joined it, they just told me that if you're wearing it, you can wear hijab. Make sure it matches your uniform. We did that. Why, if right now they have this question, why did they allow us to wear it? If they did not had a problem from this, why did they allow us at one time? That's, you know, and moreover, it is not promoting our religion. This is our way to our pride, our modesty. It's just a way of us showing us that is our, you know, this is written in our religion. That is supposed to cover us. This is our pride. We wear it as telling it's a pride that, okay, you know, we are wearing hijab, you too start wearing it. We are not promoting and provoking everyone to wear. We are just wearing it because it's in our religion.
Many political commentators see the hijab row as part of a sinister maneuver by the BJP government in New Delhi. Communal tensions at times when elections are underway to choose a new government in the country's most populous state, Uttar Pradesh. The northern instance is nearly 1,000 kilometers away from Karnataka. The hijab controversy is closely tied to the party's national electoral strategy. BJP long banked Islamophobic populism to win state elections.
The fault lines between the majority Hindu and minority Muslim community in the world's second most populous country have terrifyingly widened since the Hindu nationalist government came to power in 2014. The toxicity of hate and hostility towards Muslims, who make up around 14% of the country's 1.4 billion population, threatens to tear apart the fabric of India's secular democracy. Latest row over observance of hijab, the Muslim headscarf, has to be seen in the context of state elections in Uttar Pradesh, the most populated and the most crucial state in the country, as well as next year's election in Karnataka. The frequent communal flare-ups in India in recent years have largely happened around election time and due to incitement from radical Hindu groups. appealing to emotions of Hindu pride and invoking the imaginary fear of Islamic expansionism, has won the right-wing BJP many state elections since 2014.
Over the last, about 7-8 years, we are increasingly seeing that conversations about religion, conversations about conservative political thoughts, etc., are taking the forefront more. I think 8-10 years back when we were growing up, I don't remember having this level of conversation continuously about religion, and I felt that there was definitely the idea of secularism was a very clear idea growing up, and it was very clear to us that the Indian constitution protected all religious freedoms. And I think now you're definitely seeing a shift in that, and I think that that's sort of across the board. That's across the board with whether there are elections happening, elections not happening, and I definitely think that that is something that we are seeing a lot. And I think it would be incorrect to say that this is happening to all religions, because it is not. And in fact, we were just looking up something that, there is, like I said, Sikhs are allowed to practice their religion.
Karnataka and South India and Uttar Pradesh and North India are tied by a convoluted umbilical cord, as both states are ruled by BJP. Karnataka has emerged as the new Hindutva laboratory in South India, while Uttar Pradesh has in recent years seen a rising number of anti-Muslim hate crimes. Experts say what happens in Karnataka is directly proportional to what happens in Uttar Pradesh and vice versa.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Simi Pasha, an independent journalist from New Delhi. Welcome to the program, Simi. So as you know, the iron-fisted ban on hijab in schools in the southern Indian state of Karnataka has sparked global outcry. Do you think the ban makes mockery of the country's constitution?
Thank you so much for discussing this issue and speaking to me about it. As an Indian, it's actually deeply disturbing to witness the kind of scenes that we're seeing all over the country. It's not just down south now. There are several instances that have been reported in Uttar Pradesh and Madhya Pradesh as well, North Indian states and in central India. While the courts decide whether a ban on hijab is actually a violation of fundamental rights, in my opinion, it definitely is. It's contrary to the idea of freedom, constitutional right of freedom and equality. These are fundamental rights that the Constitution of India guarantees every citizen of the country. I beg your pardon. It's also a violation of cultural and educational rights. Article 29 of the Indian Constitution protects the rights of minorities, especially if these minority groups have their own separate culture or language or script. Article 29 of the Indian Constitution gives the minority group a right to preserve their culture and protects them by preventing the state from imposing an outside culture on them. So I think these articles, what we're seeing in Karnataka is a violation of fundamental rights. In my opinion, what the courts will be examining is whether the wearing of hijab is an essential practice under Islam, because there are two other articles of the Indian Constitution, Article 25 and 26, that allow freedom to practice any religion. So, for example, you have Sikhs in our country, people who practice Sikhism. They wear turbans on their head and they carry a kirpan, which is a small knife which they carry on them. This is allowed by the Constitution. Similarly, the courts will be examining whether wearing a hijab is an essential religious practice.
So, Simi, it started with one school, and now more schools have moved to implement a similar ban on hijab in Karnataka. Why is this piece of clothing making authorities so agitated?
So this ban on hijab has actually just come out of nowhere. We've been a secular democracy for more than 70 years. Muslim women in India have been wearing burqas and hijabs for as long as we remember. There's really no real reason. There's no reason what, nobody knows what prompted that school in Udupi, the Kundapur PU college, to issue a circular saying that girls wearing hijabs should not be allowed inside their schools. And, you know, on the 5th of February, which is 5 days before Uttar Pradesh went to polls, the state government issued an order saying that girls will not be allowed to wear hijabs because it's not part of their uniform. Now, interestingly, when the Karnataka state government issued this directive, it was imposing an already previous order that it had passed in 2013, which means almost from between 2013, when the rules were first passed, to 2022 now, almost 9 years that rule has not been implemented. 9 years later, and 5 years before Uttar Pradesh goes to polls, Karnataka decides to impose a ban on hijab, which according to it, it had passed in 2013. So the timing is really suspect, and it really makes one wonder what the motive behind this is. Interestingly, there's one little point I'd like to make. There's a video that surfaced of Bajrang Dal and Vishwa Hindu Parishad, right-wing groups, distributing saffron shawls to Hindu boys and asking them to protest against Muslim women wearing hijab. So there's that angle as well.
Some Muslim girl students have filed a petition challenging the unfair and unjust violations of their rights to religious freedom. Are courts independent enough to deliver justice?
Well, we do have utmost faith in our judicial system. And as an Indian Muslim, and as a member of an Indian society, Indian democracy, one of the world's largest democracy, I do believe that our courts will ensure that our fundamental rights are not trampled upon.
A viral video of a young Muslim student confronting a mob of Hindu vigilantes has created an international stir. How would you describe her act of resistance?
So we saw a video of this 19-year-old girl, Muskan, who shouted Allahu Akbar when she was being heckled, chased, harassed, humiliated by a group of 40 to 50 boys with saffron scarves around their necks, chanting Jai Shri Ram. If you see that video, it's actually bone-chilling because it's not just heckling and it's not just harassment on religious ground. There's also, you know, there's a threat of sexual violence as well. For that lonely girl to walk down that road from her scooter that she had parked, and she was walking inside school, it must have been a harrowing time. And for her to stand up and say Allahu Akbar, it's not just an act of resistance. I think it's an act of bravery. It's an act of courage. And in fact, in an interview to an Indian news organization, she said that for me, I said Allahu Akbar because it made me feel safe and it gave me courage. And as all Muslims, we call out to Allah when we feel unsafe or weak or under threat. And she said, that's exactly what I did.
So the hijab row has virtually divided the country among those who defend the ban and those who oppose it. What's the position of opposition parties in India on this issue?
So opposition parties usually don't speak out against persecution of Muslims because they are wary of losing Hindu votes. But in this instance, they've been surprisingly vocal. Rahul Gandhi, who leads the Congress Party, which is the principal opposition party in the country, has put out several tweets supporting the girls who are wearing their hijab, fighting for their rights. His sister Priyanka Gandhi, who's also one of the vice presidents of the party, has also put out a tweet on Twitter saying that you cannot trample upon the rights of girls to wear whatever clothing they want to wear, whatever article of clothing that they choose to wear. There are other opposition parties as well who are also speaking out. But I think it's basically the Congress which has taken up the issue. The Trinamool Congress has also made some noise about it. But for once, it has come as a surprise to everyone that opposition parties are actually standing up and speaking out against persecution of Muslim girls. Because in this instance, it's also the right-wing Hindutva groups are trying to deprive Muslim girls of their basic right to receive an education, which is extremely worrying. Because everybody knows if you educate a girl, you educate a future family, and to deprive Muslim girls and education is basically an attempt to push Muslims into an abyss of poverty, unemployment, and economic backwardness.
There you have it. Simi, thank you for being on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Nobel laureate Malala Yousafzai slams the refusal to let hijab-clad girls inside schools in India as horrifying, urging the Indian government to end the marginalization of Muslim women. Asaduddin Owaisi, a senior Indian politician and lawmaker, hails the Muslim girl who bravely confronted a Hindu mob for her commitment to education and exercising her freedom of religion and choice. A Delhi University professor, Apurva Nand, says he is ashamed and outraged by the scenes in Karnataka where Muslim women are being forced to take off hijab, calls it against all norms of civility. Irene Akbar, a journalist and social media activist, notes that Islamophobes can't digest the idea of a religious and empowered Muslim woman, which is why they oppose hijab-clad girls seeking education. Former Jammu and Kashmir Chief Minister Omar Abdullah argues that individuals must be free to choose what to wear, adding that if BJP leaders can wear saffron robes, Muslim girls can also use hijab.
And that was our episode about the unchecked assault on religious freedom of Muslims in BJP-ruled India. We shall meet again next week.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
According to reports, the Israelis are flabbergasted and scratching their heads, while their godfather, the super terrorist U.S., is as clueless as it was in July 2019 when Iranian defense has downed its most sophisticated and costliest drone that had tried to violate the Islamic Republic's airspace. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan International staff writer. This article is published under the heading Faith-Based Technology Baffles Devilish Forces. Stay tuned for more. It was the triumph of faith over faithlessness. Technology based on faith works wonders, and no matter what supposedly sophisticated equipment the faithless use, they cannot succeed. This was fully evident on Friday, February 18th, when a drone flown by Lebanon's legendary anti-terrorist movement, the Hezbollah, successfully completed its reconnaissance mission over the northern parts of occupied Palestine and returned safely to base with vital information by deftly evading the missiles fired by the racist terrorist entity, and the jets it scrambled in vain to try to down it. Indeed, this is a feather in the cap of Hezbollah, which definitely does not content itself with past laurels, but with complete trust in God Almighty is determined to upgrade its technology by leaps and bounds to shatter the so-called Iron Dome of the enemy and pierce the U.S. Patriot missile defense system. As Secretary Syed Hassan Nasrallah has said, Hezbollah is ready to export its latest defense product to qualified importers, some of whom have already booked orders. Good news for all those striving for peace, stability, freedom, justice, and self-dignity in West Asia, ranging from the Palestinian struggles to Yemen's popular Hezbollah movement. More game changers are in the offing, and without the least doubt, Syria, which is the frequent butt of Israeli terrorism, will find the rapidly developing state-of-the-art defense technology by its allies in Lebanon a welcome means in its arsenal to not just shoot down the Zionist projectiles, but to carry the battle to the enemy camp. According to reports, the Israelis are flabbergasted and scratching their heads, while their godfather, the super terrorist US, is as clueless as it was in July 2019 when Iranian defenses downed its most sophisticated and costliest drone that it had tried to violate the Islamic Republic's airspace. The Axis of Resistance has made it clear that the US occupying forces should not just leave Iraq and Syria, but the whole region, including the entire Arabian Peninsula, as well as the waters of the Persian Gulf, the Gulf of Oman, the Red Sea, and the Arabian Sea regions. This means CENTCOM terrorists are living on borrowed time, no matter if they hold naval exercises involving such strange bedfellows as the Israelis on one hand and the Saudis on the other. As for the Zionist entity, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah did not mince words when he asked the racist terrorist Israelis to leave Palestine and return to their original homeland in Europe in peace. If not, they will be forced to leave and should not blame the faithful for the calamity they are bringing upon themselves by attempting to prolong their precarious existence in Palestine, coupled with blatant interference in the affairs of several Persian Gulf reactionary states. Therefore, coordinated efforts should be made to upgrade faith-based technology, as Iran has shown with its affairs turned challenges into opportunities over the past four decades. It is time the Zionist entity realized that it is on self-destructive course. Economic divide.
Does Europe have an energy crisis?
You bet it does.
What about inflation?
That too. With some EU countries, they're worse than 30 years.
So what are authorities doing about it? Is it only because of COVID? Or are there other factors like corporate greed? Hi, I'm Kavit Tawai, and in this edition of Economic Divide, we will look at Europe's energy crisis, then a look at their economies with a case study in the UK, where things are not going well there. Coming up in today's program, the European Union's energy crunch. Almost all countries are suffering from an energy price increase. In the UK, it's over 50%. How are they going to cope with that there? Then, EU inflation. Record inflation is being registered, the worst in 30 years for some countries like the UK, like for Germany. For the poor, it's a matter of eating or heating. The middle class is also not exempt. They have been affected. And then finally, a special look at the UK and its economy. It's being hit from all sides, high energy costs on the one side. Then you have record inflation. And then you have tax increases. The road to recovery will be a long one.
The cost of living is rising in Europe against the backdrop of a crisis triggered by the COVID pandemic and tensions between Ukraine and Russia. According to the latest data, inflation across the continent has reached a new high. Consumer prices have jumped 5.1% from January of last year, up from 5% in December. That is more than what analysts had estimated. Rising inflation indicates that underlying inflationary pressures continue to build in the 19-country bloc. Soaring food prices is squeezing on family budgets. But the main reason for the rising costs in Europe is blamed on higher energy prices. Energy prices rose by 28.6% in January in the 19 Eurozone countries. The highest national inflation rate was 12.2% in Lithuania, while France had the lowest at 3.3%. Figures show that consumer prices in Germany went up 3.1% in 2021, the largest spike in 30 years. Spain is also going through a tough economic time. The country's annual inflation jumped to 6.7% at the end of 2021. Italy's inflation rate has reached a 26-year high of 4.8%, mainly due to the increase in energy prices. Government of Italy has spent more than 8 billion euros since July to curb hikes in retail energy bills. The increases are blamed on rising fossil fuel prices, which in turn is blamed on the tensions between Ukraine and Russia.
By contrast, although uncertainties related to the pandemic have abated somewhat, geopolitical tensions have increased. Furthermore, persistently high costs of energy could exert a stronger than expected drag on consumption and investment. The pace at which supply bottlenecks are resolved is a further risk to the outlook for growth and inflation.
Perhaps like no other time, governments are facing a monumental challenge of how to deal with surging prices from energy to food, which have resulted in inflation. And people are suffering as a result, as evidence in some of the social media posts. But first, the bad news got worse. The EU Commission said the forecast for inflation was revised upwards compared to the autumn forecast. This reflects the effects of high energy prices, but also the broadening of inflationary pressures on other categories of goods since autumn. Next, we pose the question, why are energy prices so high in Europe? Wholesale energy prices are soaring across Europe, especially in the UK, Spain, and Portugal, because of shortages of the supply of natural gas from Norway and from Russia. And in case you are wondering how many European countries are suffering from high energy prices, the worst hit is the UK, followed by Portugal, Spain, Italy, and Slovakia, and then followed by the rest. Now come some reasons behind the spike in energy prices, and as evident by the following posts, many are blaming the U.S. for Europe's energy woes. While Europe listens to U.S. political demands and continues to stall the completed Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which would provide needed relief amid record energy prices, Russia just announced a 30-year contract to supply gas to China with a new pipeline. The tweet said, indeed, by interfering in the delivery of much-needed natural gas supplies to the EU, it is evident the U.S. and its agents in Europe are using energy resources as a weapon. As a result, many people, especially among the poor elderly, will die this winter. Not good news there overall from the social media posts. Well, joining us for this segment of the program is Herman Kelly. He's a president of the Irish Freedom Party and a former journalist who joins us from Dublin, Ireland. Herman Kelly, welcome. The cost of living in European countries rising. You got inflation in the Eurozone that's also recording new highs. Consumer prices have jumped 5.1% from January of last year. How can any of these countries, do you think, see any reprieve from these rising prices from inflation, especially when it comes to energy prices?
Hello, Kaveh. Well, we're at a point of very high inflation now, kind of record high. I think it's the highest in 20 years. Taxation is very dangerous. It is pretty much a tax on the poor because they're asset poor and they have a lower disposable income. So prices go up, their wages stay the same, and they're less well off. Whereas the rich people who have many, like, for instance, houses and assets, the price of their assets go up, so they don't lose as much. So it really is a very dangerous time and a tax on the poor.
All right, let's bring in Urs Unkopf. He's the Federal Managing Director of BWA, Global Economic Network, who joins us from Berlin. Urs Unkopf, welcome. We're looking at the European governments that are being urged to step in to deal with the rising prices i.e. inflation or gas prices. And, of course, you've had already this input from the central banks in terms of printing money like crazy over the past couple of years since the pandemic started. How do you foresee things moving forward?
Good morning from Berlin. This is a very important question because the European Union has decided to diversify its sources of energy supply. We have to acknowledge that fossil fuels, namely oil and natural gas, will play a crucial role in the future of European energy policy and also for managing that energy transition. Natural gas, especially for Germany, has been always a very sustainable, a very secure source. And it is Germany's intention to diversify its sources, but also to strengthen established partnerships.
Okay, that was Urs Unkopf, the Federal Managing Director of BWA Global Economics Network. Time now for the InfoNews section of the program. Lots of news with an economic flavor from this past week, so here goes. First, Ukraine. The crisis continued this past week unabated. European banks, however, are panicking over the Russia-Ukraine crisis. The most exposed banks are in Italy, France, and Austria. Now, why are they panicking? Well, they've described the potential disconnection of Russia from SWIFT as what they have said is an atomic bomb for the industry. But the SWIFT disconnection, well, it remains a distinct possibility because the crisis is still ongoing. So that's news that's basically a work in progress.
First, we need to prepare very strong political and economic sanctions package. I would not exclude things like sanctioning Nord Stream 2, disconnecting from SWIFT. And I think that Russia needs to know in advance what is the economic price tag.
Next up, indebted Americans. It's unbelievable. U.S. Americans sinking deeper into debt. Last year, it actually marked the biggest annual spike in U.S. household debt in 14 years. The total household debt surged by a whopping $1 trillion. Now, this is the biggest such increase since the year 2007. The total household debt held by U.S. families at this point amounts to a figure that's quite unbelievable, $15.58 trillion, and that's growing. Moving on to the African continent, you have a drought that's happening there. The Horn of Africa is where it's happening, and it's threatening 13 million with hunger. So that's quite a number. The region is grappling with this drought that's been caused by the driest conditions since the year 1981. Now, this obviously is a major concern because of the total number of people that are involved here that are facing acute hunger. The WFP regional director, he has come out also sounding the alarm bell. And some of the things that he has said about this concerns harvest. In a tweet that he mentioned, harvests are ruined, livestock dying, and hunger is growing as recurrent drought affects 13 million people in the Horn of Africa. So obviously this needs to be addressed. And finally, we move on to something that is gonna, this is really unbelievable when you think about it. It's the Pfizer profits, and it's a bombshell. Financial results on COVID-19 vaccine sales were released, $1 million an hour with the profits from Pfizer on this vaccine that they have released to the world, which is not really all of the world. Oxfam, first of all, has said this is clear evidence of how Pfizer has used its monopoly to enrich its shareholders at the expense of almost half the world's population. But just 1% of Pfizer's vaccines have been delivered to low-income countries. So you have that going on and shows how much potential there is for more sales for Pfizer. So you go figure, profits versus lives.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It's time now for our in-depth section of the program. As we have covered in this program, energy prices across pretty much all of Europe have increased dramatically. But the country that we're going to put in focus here is the UK, whose economy is being battered from several different directions all at once. First, a look at energy bills in that country, set to rise dramatically starting from the month of April. The percentage, 54%. 54% per household. And that's Britain's energy regulator capping the increase, or else it would have been even higher. But what many people in the UK don't realize are the additional costs that come in their bill every month. Things like wholesale costs, network costs, social and environmental obligations, other direct costs, whatever that means, supplier operating costs and margin, and then taxes like VAT, something which the UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson promise to eliminate or at least reduce after Brexit. Of course, that did not happen. Let's now take a look at the price increase relative to the amount of money an average Brit makes. The average pay comes in at about £2,000 or just a little over £2,000 per month. It has been estimated families are going to now face a £1,200 a year hit to their incomes as the energy price cap is raised again for the month of April. Now, the people in the UK, like some other parts of the world, suffer from what's called fuel poverty. What is the definition of fuel poverty? Well, simply put, the condition of being unable to afford to keep one's home adequately heated. And that's something that the UK is suffering from. Now, let's put that into context. More than 2,700 deaths were reported in England and in Wales because they couldn't afford to keep their homes warm. And that was in the year 2011. Okay? Now, let's fast forward to January 2022. Fuel poverty could hit the highest level since records began unless the government acts. 6 million UK homes unable to pay their bills after the price hike now. And then 4 million who are already fuel poor, which then 2 million are going to slip into fuel poverty. So when you add these two, it comes out to that 6 million figure that we mentioned there. So obviously that's quite a number. Now, the government response, what have they done? Well, the UK Finance Minister, Rishi Sunak, he's announced a plan to ease pressure, as he has said, £350 of support. That includes £200 off energy bills from the month of October to be repaid over 5 years from next year. Okay? Now, at the same time, he warned households that they will have to adjust to even higher prices in the future. Let's take a listen to what he said.
Without government action, today's increase in the price cap would leave households needing to find, on average, an extra £693 this year. In total, we're helping the vast majority of families pay their energy bills with £350. Our plan is right. It is fair. And I hope it will help ease the anxiety that millions of people feel about rising energy costs by sharing the burden between us all.
We're going to find out if that helps or not. Obviously, it's better than nothing, to say the least here. Now, the pound, or pounding, I should say, doesn't stop there. Sorry for the pun. There is the issue of inflation for the UK. The UK is facing a wider cost of living crisis with inflation soaring. Now, what it has come in at is 7%, and that is a 30-year high. And that figure could be adjusted. Putting that aside, then comes another issue, taxes. Taxes on earned income and shareholder dividends, they're also set to rise, 2% increase. So that's another hit that the UK economy, for the average UK, or for the people in the UK, that they're going to take.